this time, and ask anybody in the audience has any follow-up. I've seen a lot of people squirming, and this is your chance to get up and get it out of your system, so please do. Paul? And I think, EJ, you'll stick with your request that people go to the mic, right? Assemblyman Miller.
I just, as far as the adequate amount of money, in our hearings, we determined that there were 303 school districts that would be getting actually a maximum of 3%, but if they didn't use pre-kindergarten funding, they'd be actually getting less than 3% increases for the next 5 years. Richard Mills indicated that the rate of education inflation in New York State was hovering around 8%, which would mean if you look at that difference over 5 years, which is compounded, the burden placed on the New York State school property taxpayer, which is everyone outside New York City, becomes enormous. And there is a projection that since there are 303 school districts that fall in that category, we might have 303 school districts on contingency by the end of 5 years. So there are some of us who actually think we may have to add a little more money. So money is still an issue. Just because the cost keeps going up and the taxpayer can't afford it anymore. But it's then a matter of not who's paying for it, but which pocket you take it out of. It's the same suit. So the debate over money isn't over, but I'm glad that we're reaching at least the beginning of a consensus that money isn't everything. I mean, without it, you could have no education. But clearly, there is no direct connection between how much we spend and what we get for the money, unless we take into account all of those fine things that we just talked about today, and that is the proper assessment, holding everyone accountable, understanding the differences in need, and addressing all of those. But unfortunately, the legislature doesn't really believe that the money issue has been totally settled, at least not over the next 5 years.
Okay. Paul?
So I like the idea that Saul had about inconvenient truths, because I think I have two or three to offer. One is, when you only look at the highest performing kids and how well they did on the NAEP, the top 10%, the talented 10th, and you look at the talented 10th today and the talented 10th in 1970, there is no difference. We are not doing a better job of educating our very best students graduating from high school today than we were. It's not like it's the bottom that's holding the United States down. The system as a whole is not making progress. Well, you could say, well, we're as good as we've ever been. And I guess if you feel that that's all we need, then you should be happy. So the second point I want to make that's an inconvenient truth is that the money problem is going to be with us as long as education is a labor-intensive industry. Because when you have almost all the progress you're going to make by hiring more people, which is what you're going to do when you reduce class size, you have an extremely labor-intensive industry that's competing in a labor market where everybody else is becoming more capital-intensive and more productive. So all other segments of the society are becoming more productive. So in order to pay teachers a competitive wage, it's got to constantly rise to keep up with other wages in the economy. Teachers' wages have gone up a lot, but teachers' wages relative to other wages haven't gone up at all. In fact, they're down when you compare them to other college-educated people. College-educated people are earning a lot more today than they were 30, 40 years ago. Teachers are earning more, but not as much as the average college-educated person. So if you're going to get the best and the brightest into education, you're going to have to either pay teachers more, or you're going to have to find out, you're going to have to pay more money into education, or you're going to have to find out how to use the money you have in education more effectively and more efficiently. And unfortunately, very little attention to that fundamental problem is on the table, even with all the other stuff that's on the table. I think this is an item that has to be placed on as well.
Dick wanted to follow up.
I'd like to ask Dr. Pearson.
Oh, you want to ask? Okay.
In the private sector, typically technology is used to enhance productivity in labor-intensive enterprises. Why hasn't that example from the private sector taken root in public education?
Well, I think the main reason is because there's no incentive. I mean, the reason why you use technology is because you want to make money. And so you're looking for ways of making workers more productive. And there's nobody's making a profit in the educational sector. And so the incentives, until you get the incentives aligned correctly, you're not going to make much progress on that front, I don't think.
Could I go in on that? Part of the problem is the when you raise the question of productivity, we don't even have any way, we don't even measure productivity in the education industry. I mean, one of our colleagues, Jay Green, just did a study, got a lot of attention based on the idea of the average hourly wage for teachers. And if you look at the average hourly wage, it looks like a lot because teachers don't work that many hours. But there's a huge gap. There's a huge spread between the actual hours that teachers work from those who come in at 8:40 a.m. with the beginning of the school day and go home at 3 and hardly take any work home with them, and those many who are very, very dedicated and put in, you know, an 8-hour, 9-hour day at school and then still take work home and work on the weekends and prepare. And we have no way of capturing that or even beginning to measure it. It would be unheard of in the sanitation department to not measure worker productivity. But in education, we don't measure it. We just accept the fact that the school day, you know, is the length of the day for kids. So unless we begin, and that's certainly something that should be put on the table, try to distinguish between the, and I hope there are no gym teachers in the room, try to distinguish between the seventh grade gym teacher who comes in at 8:40 a.m., goes home at 3 p.m., and spends this entire day rolling basketballs out on the court, and the seventh grade math teacher who's grading 150 papers, or tests every week or two, and is putting in probably a 60-hour week during the weeks that school is on. And yet the seventh grade gym teacher, because he may have 20 years of seniority, could be making twice as much as a seventh grade math teacher. We have to address that.
Okay, I got to go back to Dick now before somebody else says something that he has to respond to.
Actually, I just wanted to add my comments and my thoughts to Dr. Peterson's point about the top 10%. And I would ask us to also look at that top 10%, because I think you're absolutely right. And when we talk about a global economy and a flattening of the world and having to deal, one of the places that we have to put our attention is with that top 10%. And I would suggest that we need to look at the way we test, because and I know you've both brought the issue up, but when testing concentrates on punishments and punitive measures, the school district, the school board, the superintendent, the classroom teacher has no choice but to concentrate on trying not to be punished, which means they don't give the kind of attention that needs to be given to the top 10%. And I think that that's where we're failing ourselves. We're concentrating on avoiding punishment, and so we're not putting in the time and energy we should for making that top 10% world class, which is where they should be.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, as it still is. My name is Roberto Reyes. I work at the State Ed Department, and I'm also a product of the school system that you're trying to fix. I think we would be remiss if we didn't take this opportunity to also indicate that the conversation has to be expanded. It cannot be just about education or the education budget, because the social pathologies that exist in the communities where these children that are the lowest performing are going to require the interventions of many agencies across our state to be well coordinated, and that those resources be brought to bear on the problems that exist in our communities. About 10 years ago, I can't say that I remember the author's name, but the name of the article resonated with me enough that I've kept it in the back of my head forever, and it was What No School Can Do. And it articulated all of the myriad of social problems that exist in these communities. And when the commissioner and the Board of Regents have committed to a P16 system of bringing the full force of the University of the State of New York to the problems of education in our state, it signifies a significant step that needs to be taken further, and that conversations or dialogues such as this one today should bring partners from the other sectors of state government to make sure that there's a full court press on the problems that we're trying to fix. Thank you.
Tom, you talked about some of that earlier. You want to...
I did, and you're talking exactly about the issues of poverty and how best do we remediate. We know that we're not going to change societal poverty overnight, although if we really want to improve not only the bottom 10% but the top 10%, that's one of the things that we should do as a society. But we're going to have to find a way to serve people more efficiently. And I'm imagining a single parent with perhaps just two kids trying to coordinate a social service worker for each one of those kids, a Child Health Plus doctor for each one of those kids, some sort of a state dental program. We have all these programs in place, but I'm a state government professional. I've been in Albany for 18 years. I wouldn't know how to navigate that maze. I can't imagine someone who may have to work two jobs figuring out how to serve their kid. Schools have the kids all during the day. We know how to track them. We have data systems in place for being able to tell what they have and haven't taken advantage of, and then we could correlate some of that with their student achievement data. Schools are the ideal place to situate those kinds of supports for families, and we should really be thinking about breaking down the barriers between all these state agencies that are then replicated in barriers at the local level and find ways of coordinating all of those services in ways that families can really take advantage of them so that we can remediate the effects of poverty, even if we're not ready to remediate poverty itself directly. And I just had, I wanted to take a stab at answering Chancellor Hayden's question about technology. I think the reason why we haven't expanded technology in education is partly because we don't have any good models for how it improves instruction. All of the technology models we have right now mirror the least effective instructional techniques that we have. So we have workbooks where kids fill things out. We have workbooks that are on screen where kids type the answer in, and it's a little more colorful, but it's the same instructional technique. And what we're doing right now, somebody standing at a podium doing a PowerPoint, that's called frontal teaching. And it is one of the oldest and probably least effective pedagogical techniques for kids, the teaching techniques. So if you have a large, you could do this with any size class. We could have a class of 200 people in here, and the takeaway for the individuals wouldn't change because it's frontal teaching to all of them. Now, this can't be called team teaching, having all of us up here, because we're not interacting with anyone. We're just taking turns frontal teaching. So if you want to get the benefit of smaller class sizes, you have to have ways of being able to take advantage of different pedagogical modalities that are possible with those smaller groups, and no one's figured out how to do that with technology yet. What technology replicates is frontal teaching on a massive scale. So there are very few subjects that lend themselves to frontal teaching, and those handful of places would be a place where it would make a lot of sense. But you're not going to get any kinds of real productivity gains if you're just replicating the weakest instructional technique we know, and we're doing it over the internet instead of doing it in a classroom. That's my thought on it.
Thanks. That's an interesting observation. I want to get Tim in here for a minute and maybe one last question after him.
Just a couple observations. I mentioned we have a value-added pilot project underway, and we had Cohoes, which is located nearby. The superintendent Cohoes was describing how they are using that data, and to piggyback on something Dick said, it was because of the availability of that data, they noted that their students who were the ones in the AP classes, the ones who they would have expected to make the most progress from year to year, were not making any progress at all. In fact, some of them were falling behind. They noted that those who were at the lowest performing levels were making the greatest progress. And that is indeed where they had been putting their resources. So what they saw is, yes, indeed, where we're putting our resources, we're getting the best bang for our buck, but we're ignoring these gifted kids, and in fact, they're falling behind. So that without that value-added data, they would not have known that, and now they have a resource allocation question. The last observation I want to share with you is I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. just a short time ago, There was a gentleman named David Warlick, who was out of North Carolina, who was talking about technology. And he shared with us just this amazing presentation. In fact, we're bringing him to our annual convention in October. This amazing presentation where he showed the access that kids have using technology. You know, the computers, the cell phones, the iPods, and everything in between. And we asked him, okay, turn all that off, come into the classroom, we're going to teach you in the traditional sense, and then afterwards, okay, now you're back out into the connected world. And how there is this, in their minds, this disconnect as to the reality of the classroom versus the reality of their lives. And it occurs to me, as Dr. Peterson talks about it, that the technology may just surpass what we're able to offer, and that our ability, our job will then be to help kids learn to teach themselves rather than us teaching them.
Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter Murphy with the Charter Schools Association. I wonder if some of you could address what role, if any, competition should play in public education now. I'm with the Charter Schools Association. That is a competitive challenge charter schools are to a number of districts. And this governor is not only wanting to expand the number, but also cushioning that competitive challenge they bring to, you know, sort of soften that fiscal impact over some years, but not eliminating it in the long term. So he seems to be maintaining that competitive nature of them and wanting more. Could you address that? Because our concern is that the charter school law maintain that competitive challenge aspect to it and not become a Potemkin law that does exist in a number of states where charter schools are either ineffective or non-existent.
Well, let me throw this to Dick.
Well, I assume everybody would not be able to figure out what was happening if he didn't throw it to Dick. So I haven't, which is fine. I don't think there's any surprises in the room when I say to you that charter schools present a real problem for NYSET, and not necessarily the term competition, by the way, because I would argue with you that every school district is in competition with 700 other school districts on Long Island. If you are in Central Islip, you're in competition with the district next to you because everybody wants to know why your school district isn't performing as well. And we had 5 elementary schools. Every elementary school was in competition with the elementary school next door in the district. So it's not the issue is in competition. My difficulty with the charter school movement is simply that if we have issues in the what I would call public school, and I appreciate the fact that charter schools are public schools, but if we have issues in the public school, we have to concentrate all of our efforts on fixing them in the public schools. We are doing nothing of value to what's happening in my classroom or in my school if we simply take the money and create something next door. It's not a statement that there is nothing to fix. There is things to fix in public schools. There are places where we have failed. There are places where we must improve. My point is just that's where we have to put our concentration, and moving someplace else to do it doesn't answer the question.
Can I answer? Carl, you got a closing? Oh, no.
Saul's going to explode here.
I'll be in the minority of one because there are 5 of you. The fact is, the way in which we're even discussing charter schools is just upside down. It's very similar to the CFE case where we talked about dollars and not education. I'm in favor of no cap at all. Why should we have any limit to the number of schools if they're good schools? What we should concentrate on is not arguing about the numbers. We should concentrate about how we vet the schools. We should make charter schools come before they get started to prove that they will be using programs and approaches that they can make a reasonable argument for based on evidence that will outperform the public schools for a particular population in that area. That should be the only issue if we care about education, not the numbers.
All right, Chancellor, you get the last word.
Okay. A couple of thoughts on charter schools. I've supported charter schools, still do. on the basis that I think that they can be very effective laboratories. I'm not sure they have been so far because I haven't seen much, if any, by way of replicable product out of the charter schools. What I see are examples of fabulous charter schools like Brighter Choice, Tom Carroll's, but in the same city, I see a charter school which, if it was being held to the standard advanced by its proponents, should have been closed, but wasn't. So on the subject of accountability, there's a big gap in the rhetoric. I would really love to see charter schools as a laboratory do what a laboratory should do. I'm not sure you're advancing the public good if all the charter schools represent is a hostile takeover of public education.
Thank you. We obviously could go on for a long time having warmed up, but we've hit the end of the line. And to be continued in some form, I'm sure. I want to thank everybody very much for attending today. I want to remind you again that our website, www.empirecenter.org, we'll get the conference materials, that is the PowerPoints and Tom's report, which will also be on his website, on our site, hopefully as soon as this afternoon or tomorrow morning. We'll have MP3 sound files by early next week. And last but not least, we'll have a transcript. If you're registered or RSVP'd for this conference and we have your name and address, you will get a copy of the transcript or you'll receive something telling you how to get the transcript. We're hoping to have it in a month or so, and hopefully perhaps even sooner than then. But you can reach out. If you go to www.empirecenter.org and you're wondering where the transcript is, it's easy to contact us through the website at the contact emails, either my own or info@empirecenter.org. And if you're itching to get it, just let us know so that you can see it. You can pull out things you remember being said, or you want to take things out of context and use them against people in the room, that you can also do that. Thank you very, very much for attending, and thank you to all of our panelists.